the European Roundtable for Industry. And my guest today is ERT member Sir Jonathan Simons.
Don't worry about your next promotion, but worry about, you know, where your next skill is going to come from and how are you going to develop yourself. I just loved the concept of putting a team together and the whole exceeding the sum of its parts. Europe has to address the commercial scale-up challenge and have the desire to build big multi-billion dollar biopharma life science businesses in Europe and to keep them in Europe.
Hello, and welcome to 21st Century Industrialists, a series of interviews with some of Europe's most successful business leaders. I'm Robert O'Mara from ERT, the European Roundtable for Industry, and today I'm in London to meet the ERT member, Sir Jonathan Simons, the chairman of the global biopharmaceutical powerhouse that is GSK. A maven of the bridge between finance and life sciences, he's had a distinguished career that has seen him work in some of the best-known pharmaceutical companies and investment banks in the world. Sir John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I don't know if you're a keen listener to all of the episodes, but as you may be aware, we like to dig into a bit of what the early years were like. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Cambridge, in the UK. It was a fairly simple upbringing, actually. My father worked in local government. My mother was a cost clerk, and I went to the local school and progressed from there.
And did you have siblings?
Yes, I have a brother.
And were your parents very demanding of you and your brother?
In some ways, you know, and I try and reflect of, you know, so what is it that given me this tremendous determination to achieve? And I think it goes back to my father. He was born in 1927, so when the war started, he was in his early teens. And he was both ill and, I think, suffered from nutritional deficiencies. And as a result, his education was quite significantly disrupted. And so he felt, and he would say this all the way through my life, you know, make the best you possibly can and take every opportunity and don't ever let anything go. And, you know, I think it was through his dissatisfaction of his own educational upbringing that, you know, that he never wanted me not to miss out on the opportunities that he felt that he did. My mother is an incredibly strong character. So I think it was an environment where it was quite clear that I shouldn't miss the opportunities that came before me. And I think the two things that they kept saying was, be the best you possibly can be. And secondly, if you're going to do something, do it to the very best of your ability. And I'm still driven to those two things. I still hunger to do things, and I always want to do it the best I possibly can.
I can imagine that that kind of thing really, really sinks in. So what did you study at university then?
So, you know, my parents didn't push me to university. I think my father most definitely wanted me to go, but didn't demand it. And I actually had a sort of modestly successful football career going on at the same time.
Well, this isn't in the research. Wow.
And no, this was in a semi-professional club in Cambridge where I achieved more than I think I had the ability to justify. So I didn't actually feel the need to go to university, and I wanted to get a job and continue playing football. But I did go to train as an accountant, found I really, really enjoyed it, stayed on to do a degree, and, you know, did very well. But it was an opportunistic approach rather than a carefully planned approach. But actually, I did learn something that has also stayed with me throughout my career, is that, you know, I had modest ability. There were people around me who were much more talented than I, but I just loved the concept of putting a team together and the whole exceeding the sum of its parts. And that's what I've sought to do in my life ever since, is to build teams that can deliver more than any individual can aspire to. And that goes back to those early days with football.
I want to achieve something. I think deeply about the environment on both sides. I profoundly believe that in everything there is a win-win.
Okay, so you've completed your financial accounting qualification, and if my research is right, you embarked on your career with KPMG.
Yes.
Were you working with a lot of focus on the UK, or was it really very, very broad and international?
It was very broad. I worked in the US for a couple of years, but I think the defining moment was when I came back from the US. The firm had just merged and the beginnings of KPMG were starting to emerge, and I was asked to manage the ICI audit, a company that doesn't exist today, Imperial Chemical Industries, which was in those days, you know, the largest industrial company in the UK. And that's what exposed me to the chemical sector and pharmaceuticals. And that's where I became really quite interested, the application of science and business. And I found that really fascinating. And I think that is what in my, really the rest of my career was that interest stemming from that time.
So during those 17 years at KPMG, or what became KPMG, you garnered a lot of experience in corporate restructuring. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, this was a, another opportunity that came across and one that I grasped, and that was to be seconded to ICI for nearly three years, from 1990 to 93, to help create Zeneca, the pharmaceutical business out of the chemical, the ICI chemical portfolio. And it was really learning the physical separations of companies. I mean, it wasn't the corporate finance, the sexy piece of it. This was just the, you know, the basics of how you build two new companies. And I really loved that. And I built a team to do it. And I found that what I didn't want to do was to sort of, when it was finished, let this team sort of disband. And
how big was the team?
There was about 10 of us.
Okay.
And then the same team then went to the Netherlands, and we worked with Shell on the separation of the polyolefins business and the merger of that polyolefins business with Montedison, an Italian company. So I was sort of dually living in The Hague and Milan. Guess which one I preferred. But it was a wonderful experience to see that, you know, there were two European companies, but the challenge of merging a Dutch company with a mercurial Italian company was a wonderful experience of, you know, just how important cultural appreciation was, and to be able to recognize how to actually achieve something in those difficult situations.
I can imagine there must have been a lot less literature available on working in multicultural teams and, you know, getting international projects over the line. I can imagine that there wasn't remotely as much literature as there is now.
No, there wasn't.
How did you navigate that?
No, there wasn't. I mean, by making up as I went along. But because I can remember that the person involved at the team at Shell, he was on the CMD. So he was a very, very senior man at Shell, a wonderful man that I learned so much from. But he basically could not cope, you know, with these negotiations, which he thought was finished beautifully at the last meeting and would start from where it finished, only to realize that actually the Italians didn't accept anything of what had gone on the previous meeting. And actually, you know, we were back to square one. So I remember him saying John, you've got to chair these negotiations. And I was what? I was in my early 30s. And he asked me to sort of navigate between, you know, the Dutch culture and the Italian culture. And actually, it was a fascinating experience. And, you know, what it just, you know, you learn, actually, in leadership is that, you know, you listen, you steer, and you create an environment where you can achieve things. And it was a fascinating, fascinating experience.
What do you think was the secret ingredient that you were bringing to the table?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have many what I would call accidental conversations. If I want to achieve something, I think deeply about, you know, the environment on both sides. So what do I want to achieve? Where is the position of the other person? How do we navigate the conversation to a point where you can get a resolution? I profoundly believe that in everything, there is a win-win.
Okay. And Zeneca came knocking in 1997, is that right?
Yes. Yes.
So, all right. Tell us about Zeneca and how that started. So you're going from the variety of KPMG, you know, now hurtling into the world of biopharma and life sciences.
Yes, and I think I still to this day don't quite know why I got the job, because, you know, I was 37 at the time, and, you know, there were no other CFOs of top 10 companies in the UK of that age. I'd never worked in business before, and I think I owe a lot to the chief executive and the finance director, who clearly, I think, saw more in me than I probably saw in myself. But 1997, and the pharma world was beginning to consolidate. I remember in my interview saying, how long is this job for? You know, because Zeneca was constantly in the news as a takeover target. Actually, GSK was constantly in the news as wanting to acquire Zeneca. But very quickly, we started merger negotiations with Astra. You know, I led the negotiations for Zeneca with Astra. And I think I'd learned a lot from the Dutch-Italian experience, although I think the British-Swedish experience was, you know, much more compatible.
Were there any particular moments in that merger that still stick in your mind that you think, yeah, that was the key moment, that was the key turning point? Or,
well, I think there were, and I think even today, you know, the merger of Astra and Zeneca would be regarded as a huge success, and obviously, you know, what AstraZeneca has done in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years has been exceptional. And mm-hmm. So, you know, credit to them for that. But actually, I think the Anglo-Swedish nature has retained intact. And I think it was because they were two culturally compatible organizations. But they merged because both believed that it was the right thing to do. The merger negotiations were complicated, but there was always a list of, here's what we need to do. Here's why this is the right thing. And whenever it got difficult, you know, we go back to that list. You know, we got through it because of that. To being Goldman through the financial crisis of 2007, 8 and 9 was the most amazing education I think I've ever had.
So you left the world of AstraZeneca and you moved to Goldman Sachs in 2007.
Yes.
One of what has to be one of the most fraught times in recent history in terms of economic and financial crisis resonating across the four corners of the world. Although, let's face it, this is not exactly a calm moment either. What tempted you to make such a move?
There was good and bad. I mean, I can talk about it more comfortably now, but I mean, I came second in the contest to be CEO of AstraZeneca. I was massively disappointed not to get that job, and the person that did, David Brennan, I'm proud to say, is still a great friend of mine to this day. But I couldn't stay. I mean, I did stay for a while, but I'd moved. Emotionally, I'd moved to wanting to be taking my own decisions. And, You know, I didn't want to sit in meetings where I didn't have the same view as David. So I left. And actually, I decided, literally thought, what's the most difficult thing I can do to really challenge myself? I didn't want to go back into another pharma company at that point. So I went to become a partner at Goldman. And as it turned out, it was probably the least financially lucrative years in Goldman's history, but probably the most lucrative years in educational content. And so to be in Goldman through the financial crisis of 2007, 8, and 9 was the most amazing education I think I've ever had.
You're talking, so 2007, so you were 47? Is that right?
Yes.
I mean, to step into a completely different sector and have to, well, to be, you know, high up in the company, but then also to be in a situation where you're learning that much new stuff at that level, there's got to be an edge to that when you get up in the morning and you go to work and you're kind of like, okay, I am bringing this value and I am learning about these things and that, you know, these are the reasons why I'm here.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it was probably, you put it like that, Robert. I mean, I think it was harder than I imagined because I went into this firm with, you know, having achieved quite a lot, actually. Done one of the biggest mergers in the pharmaceutical industry, had restructured AstraZeneca, become a pure play pharma business. And then, you know, I went and quite literally given an office with furniture that was 50 years old and told to get on with it. But actually, it was a massive culture shock. I wanted to get another education and boy, I got one. But the reason why it was so short was because I couldn't reconcile giving advice and being accountable. And there was limited satisfaction in saying to a board or a chief executive or a, you know, here's what I do, here's what I recommend, and not being able to go and do it. And so when Dan Vasella called and said, look, would you come and be CFO of Novartis in Switzerland? Actually, I did decide very quickly that I wanted to go back and be truly accountable for what I was doing, but way more competent and financially skilled than I was the day I left AstraZeneca.
How long did it take you in Goldman Sachs to sort of, before you had that day where you were like, okay, I think I'm up to speed? Are we talking weeks or months?
No, I don't think I ever reached that point, actually, partly because I think, as you rightly say, we were literally on the edge of financial Armageddon. And I remember Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO, who I got to know really well and admired enormously. He, in the depths of the financial crisis, would organize Sunday evening partner calls. And, you know, this was very late in the evening in Europe. And he'd basically start off by saying, you know, here's what I know, here's what I don't know, and we may not be in business next week. You got this real impression that you were on the edge. And he would always finish the call by saying, now you know exactly what I know. Go to work tomorrow and serve your clients. And actually what he did was, A, communicate in the most unbelievably transparent and honest way. We literally did not know whether we'd be in business, you know, the following week. It was right on the edge. But what he did was eliminated, you know, the endless hours of speculation that would have gone on about what was going to happen. We quite literally could go in on a Monday morning and serve our clients because we knew what Lloyd knew, and there was no point trying to speculate what he knew that he didn't say. But it was extraordinary, and I had the confidence to go into the financial services industry because I had seen it, you know, in the depths of the crisis.
Really interesting. I'm struck by the number of times that you kind of, you were on track for a particular thing or you were aiming for a particular thing and that thing maybe didn't work out. But then something even better came along. You were able to move on quickly and dig into the next thing that piqued your curiosity.
Yeah, that's a very, it's a very good observation. And I'm not sure that I can present any great theory behind that. But I have always sought to broaden my skill base. You know, and you can see whether it's been in finance or, you know, learning science and finance or participating in, you know, major business transactions or even indeed societal things. And it's always put me in a position where when new opportunities come along, I've had plenty of choice. But there is this, and I still have it to this day, this deep desire if something new and different is on offer. You know, how exciting is it to go and learn something new? And eventually all these things come together. And there's no doubt that I've achieved more because I've accumulated lots of things along the way than I have in just say, I'm going to set my stall on a linear career and I want to go from here to there in a straight line. It just doesn't happen that way. And I think, you know, I say this a lot to young people, don't worry about, you know, your next promotion, but worry about, you know, where your next skill is going to come from and how are you going to develop yourself?
I really like that. But I think society is still kind of learning. It's still learning the validity of that in some ways. And I'm interested, what advice do you give to the younger generations on, you know, keeping that learning muscle moving or learning something new just when you think you might know it all?
I don't think there's an easy answer to that. And I don't think, I mean, I have had this lifelong passion for learning and I can cope with uncertainty. As long as I have choices, then I'm very happy to pursue and exist in an uncertain world. And, you know, that's been the pattern through my career. I'm also very well aware, you know, there are lots of people that can't cope with that. And I think that this is one of the key attributes of leadership. And in many ways, Lloyd, you know, the example I gave of Lloyd, you know, in the midst of the most uncertainty, gave people certainty. You know, now I know what I need to know and I can go off and do it. And so, but I think that leadership is about, you know, existing in an uncertain world, translating that uncertainty and trying to give as much certainty to people as possible because, you know, at the end of the day, people have got to do their jobs and achieve things. They've got to accomplish things. You've got to make products. You've got to deliver to customers. You've got to make customers feel great, etc. And I think that it is increasingly, I think, a skill of leadership to be able to interpret trends and to be able to, you know, provide certainty as far as you can. I think if Europe wants to succeed, you've got to have a desire to both consume the fruits of European innovation rapidly and determinedly, and to want to build big businesses in Europe.
From 2014 to 2020, you went back to the world of finance with the chairmanship of HSBC?
Well, I was based in London, and this was another career decision which gave me the opportunity to chair HSBC's European Bank. It was about 40% of the group with big banks in Germany, France, the UK, and to implement the legislation that forced the separation of retail banking from investment banking. So it's sort of back to a big corporate reconstruction. It was a highly regulated industry. And therefore I learned, you know, in a large scale, but in a fairly protected way, you know, how to build a board, how to engage with management, how to accomplish something that was really very, very significant. And I loved it. And then when I'd finished the separation, I became deputy chairman of the group and worked with the new chair coming in, build a new strategy for HSBC, and again, deepened my knowledge of macroeconomics and Asia and China, you know, which, you know, is of huge value to me now.
Okay, so all of that while you'd been that you were with HSBC, you were also engaged with the expanding world of tech in Silicon Valley.
I chaired a startup in Silicon Valley, which we buried a couple of years ago. It wasn't successful, but it was just a wonderful experience on, you know, some of the really big trends going on in science and technology and the fusion of that. And it really formed the, that really formed the platform when I was asked to consider GSK in 2019.
That must have been a very different culture to the culture that you were used to in the worlds of financial accounting and even life sciences in Switzerland, for example, to go to Silicon Valley and be among the, well,
yeah, no, well, it
to
was.
To be among the Mark Zuckerbergs and others, was there a big culture gap there?
Yeah, there was. Yes, there was. And, you know, you realized, you know, at this point, you know, my career had been in finance and big companies, and I quite literally knew nothing about, you know, how about going to raise small amounts of money to keep businesses alive, and how to build business models out of ideas. And the company I chaired was at an amazing, it's still the best idea that's never worked that I've ever been involved with. And I learned a lot about, you know, what it takes to be an entrepreneur. I'm not an entrepreneur, but I now understand, you know, how they work, how they think. And I understand the software development cycle in Silicon Valley, and I understand data and the importance of data and AI and analytical techniques probably quite well, actually.
So on the back of all of that, then you get a phone call in 2019 from GSK, the old rival, saying, we'd like to have a chat. And what was the substance of what followed?
You know, GSK is, you know, has been one of the scientific pillars of the UK for, you know, my entire career. And it had been usurped by AstraZeneca, having been, you know, the minnow. You know, the AstraZeneca had become the whale. And so the opportunity to participate in, you know, rekindling GSK to its former glory was really quite appealing. And two things persuaded me really very quickly. Number one, the CEO, Emma Walmsley, her drive, her determination, her willingness to tackle the fundamentals. And secondly, when I explored what the scientific strategy of GSK was, you know, it's essentially the science of the immune system, genetics, and big data and AI. And then the big data and AI immediately played into my Silicon Valley experiences. The genetics piece immediately played into the Genomics England experiences. And so actually, you know, literally was a, you know, light bulb moment. Yes, this is where I want to come. And, you know, the added benefit was, yes, there's another separation and big corporate restructuring and demerger. And okay, yeah, I can do that. It's been unfinished, but it will always be unfinished. But I think
work in progress.
It's work in progress, yeah. But the dream of, you know, returning GSK to become a real powerhouse of biopharma, you know, with a new unique proposition built around data and analytics and AI and machine learning is, I think, really energizing.
I mean, how different a company is GSK today from the one it was, say, 5 or 10 years ago?
I think it's quite different from the one that it was within the last 5 years. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, the analysis that Emma did, and definitely was consistent with the analysis that I had done. I mean, it's got a wonderful heritage in vaccines. It's one of the, you know, most distinguished, respected companies on the global health. You know, we serve, you know, a third of the world's children with pediatric vaccines. And so it really quite literally does serve global health. But it wasn't completely competitive. Its cost base wasn't efficient. There was a capital allocation challenge. The culture needed to be much more results orientated. And I think Emma and the team have done a fabulous job tackling those fundamentals. So I think, you know, we're in very, very good shape now. And, you know, we've now got to execute against that strategy and show everybody that this can be, you know, really valuable contribution both to shareholders and wider society.
This seems about the right point in the conversation to dig in and kind of discuss the position that the life sciences sector occupies in Europe and beyond. Am I right in saying that it's a sector of real strength for Europe?
Yes. Yes.
Do you think that that position was strengthened during COVID?
Yes, certainly Europe did come more to the forefront. I mean, there are strengths and weaknesses, both in Europe and in the UK. And, you know, both have very strong science bases. And if you think about the European contribution to COVID, you know, one of the vaccines came from the UK. Most of the influential sequencing of the pathogen and the determinant of the variants came from the UK. Most of the production came from Europe, Belgium in particular. I mean, the Pfizer vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine, GSK's got a big vaccine manufacturing base in Belgium. BioNTech, CureVac come from Germany. There's a lot of vaccine capability in Italy. So there was a tremendous contribution. But if you stand back and say, you know, where was value creation?
Mm-hmm.
Pfizer, Moderna. You know, and so I think that this is the real challenge of the UK and Europe, is the translation of a very strong science engine into European jobs and European value creation without the export of both of those components to the US. And I think that, you know, Europe has to address the commercial scale-up challenge and have the desire to build big multi-billion dollar biopharma life science businesses in Europe and to keep them in Europe without succumbing to US capital and US capital markets. It's a big challenge. And I think if Europe wants to succeed, you've got to have a desire to both consume the fruits of European innovation rapidly and determinedly, and to want to build big businesses in Europe. And there hasn't been many billion-dollar life sciences companies created in Europe in, you know, a long time.
So, well, let's stick with that theme of new innovation for a moment. I mean, we have record numbers of researchers in Europe.
Yes.
Yet the number of patent applications is lower than elsewhere. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think it comes down to, you know, are we pursuing science as an academic pursuit, or are we pursuing it to create something, to create a product, to create a therapeutic, to create a company, to create a business? And I think that this is where I stood on the steps of Stanford University many, many times. And you know, the integration of scientific, deep scientific education, but with entrepreneurialism as its partner. And we don't teach entrepreneurialism. You know, we don't teach scientists and business people what it is to build a company, how to get capital. And you look at the Stanford campus, it's literally what the students demand. You know, they create a patent, create a company.
And what can we do to improve that in Europe? If you've got a call from half a dozen universities tomorrow and asking you, you know, what should we do to actually improve that conversion from, you know, research to patent to innovation to market?
Yeah.
Actually,
I did get that call in the middle of 2021 and was asked with an outstanding Oxford professor, John Bell, to write a strategy, post-COVID strategy for UK science. And we did, and we created a vision of what life sciences in the UK could look like. And it included recommendations on the focus of scientific investment. The UK and Europe invest huge amounts of money into science, both government and in the university sector. But there's no sort of strategic resource allocation model. And, you know, what we're trying to drive the resources against is the diseases that really affect humanity today. There still is cardiovascular disease, there's mental health, there's the aging, there's dementia, there's neurodegeneration, etc. You know, can we really focus our efforts to really pursuing government, academic and commercial missions to do that, to increase the appetite and the pace of adoption of technology within the NHS, to recognize that data sets are the lifeblood of future science. In fact, biology is now determined by data science and the analytics that go with it, and to create scale-up capital. And so these were really the four recommendations that we have, but they've been very widely adopted. And I see no reason why the report that John and I did could not easily become a template for Europe and the European Commission. It's exactly the same. It's exactly the same challenges. What I love about my career is that I'm still learning. I'm still generating new skills. And a lot of people's disappointments come because they look to linear paths. It's not a linear path. It never will be.
This interview is actually being recorded just a few days after the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II. And you are the very first knight that we have had on this podcast. Can you talk to us a little bit about how and when you received that honor, and what was it like? How did you feel?
Well, I don't think for a British citizen there's anything more than you can be proud of, and that is to be recognized by your nation for the contribution that you've made. So I am deeply, deeply proud and humbled for that. And you actually never really know. You never really know why. You just get a letter in the post that says, you know, the Prime Minister is minded to recommend to Her Majesty this honour. Please confirm if she offers it to you, you will accept it. And you go back and say, of course, yes. You will hear nothing more. And you read it in the newspaper and it comes out.
Oh, you read it in the newspaper?
You read it in the newspaper.
And I have to ask, you mentioned your formidable mother earlier in this interview. How did she react when you called her and you said, Mum, I'm becoming a...
Yeah, we both reacted. We both reacted in exactly the same way, and that was, wouldn't your father have been proud, because he had passed away before then? And I think, you know, that we both recognised actually that it would meant as much to him as it did to me because of what I was saying at the beginning. So I think we both had the similar response.
Well, you know, you must have a lot of people coming to you saying, you know, I'm starting my career or I'm in the middle of my career. You know, do you have a sort of a standard nugget of advice or a motto or a quote that you share with people?
No, not really. Although I do a lot of coaching. You know, I've got four or five new CEOs that I coach, and I've just become chair of an organization that does people development in the UK. But I think it is what I love about my career is that I'm still learning. I'm still generating new skills. And a lot of people's disappointments come because they look to linear paths. It's not a linear path. It never will be. And I think it's as much incumbent on the individual to develop themselves than it is to wait for their employer to tell them what they're going to do next. And, you know, I think that's what I continually broaden myself. And I think with broadening comes new opportunity. And that's what I really impress on people is, you know, build yourself. And, you know, what I love to see is people that take one or two sideways moves to develop a new skill or a new experience or do something and then jump three levels. So, you're never too old for a new career.
I really like that advice. And I think a lot of our listeners will too. You are a longstanding member of ERT. You have said that you're a committed European. How do you describe your prevalent emotion for the EU as a project, and what do you think its future is?
I'm a committed European and always have been, and I've spent, you know, most of my life working in, out, across, through Europe, and I'm deeply proud to be a member of the ERT. You know, it's an organization that has the opportunity to make a real difference. And I think many of the projects that the ERT have done around, you know, competitiveness, the single market and so on is hugely respected. And so I think with the challenges going on in the world and in Europe at the moment, you know, I think that Europe's success and business success will be founded on deeper collaboration. And I believe that, you know, that is what we will achieve in the coming years, because the 60 members of the ERT, you know, have the capacity collectively to move mountains quite literally. And I think we're in a great position to significantly improve the long-term prospects of Europe.
This was this month's episode of 21st Century Industrialists, brought to you by ERT. The interview you've been listening to was edited for brevity. I was your host, Robert O'Mara. You can find out more about who else worked on this episode by checking the show notes. For more information on ERT, check out our website at ert.eu. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and tell your friends. We'll be back with another episode next month. Thank you for listening.